Cause number 132320CR, ex parte Carlos Noé Gallegos.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The Supreme Court has stated that the right to acquire American citizenship is a precious one, and once citizenship has been acquired, its loss can have severe and unsettling consequences. This case involves the loss of the precious right of citizenship due to the ineffective assistance of Mr. Gallegos' trial counsel. The state does not concede that Padilla versus Kentucky applies, but it assumes that it does. And the state likewise admits that the trial court's findings did not explicitly hold that trial counsel's performance was deficient, but assumes that it was. Because the state's brief focuses on prejudice, I'm going to briefly open on those first two issues and spend the majority of my time on the prejudice analysis.
I have a question, the get-go. Are you asking for us to a state appellate court to expand Padilla, which is obviously a U.S. Supreme Court case that deals specifically with deportation of non-citizens to naturalized citizens, in this case, denaturalized citizens, and what authority would we have to do this?
So the state's argument in this regard is that the state says and concedes that it applies to adverse immigration consequences and deportation. Well, that's exactly what this is. And so if you look at the reasoning of Padilla, you don't have to expand it at all, because denaturalization is an immigration consequence that leads to deportation. And we did argue in the trial court that if Mr. Gallegos' naturalization was revoked, he would revert to the status of a lawful permanent resident, and then he would be deportable under 8 U.S.C. Section 1227. And we have cited several cases applying Padilla in this context. We've cited one from the Fifth Circuit, the United States versus Coyote case, and then one from the Second Circuit, Rodriguez versus United States. The state cites a case called Farhain. It's from the Southern District of New York. That case does not say that Padilla does not apply in the circumstances. Rather, in that case, the court held that the defendant failed to prove ineffective assistance. So I think there's precedent out there for applying it in this context. And I think the rationale of Padilla applies because of the immigration and deportation consequences. So that was kind of everything I was going to say about why Padilla applies. So I'll move on to the next topic. Gallegos' counsel did render defective performance. The state concedes that the trial court didn't make any express findings on trial counsel's defective performance, but it's implied by the finding that Mr. Gallegos didn't meet his burden. Gallegos pleaded in his habeas petition that his trial counsel affirmatively told him that there would not be any immigration consequences as a result of the plea, and also failed to advise Mr. Gallegos that if he pleaded guilty, that would lead to denaturalization and deportation. And the reason that that's defective is because if you if you're applying for naturalization, you have to have good moral character during the residency period before you apply. And the residency period is 5 years. So for the 5 years before 2010, when Mr. Gallegos was naturalized, he had to show he had good moral character. You can't have good moral character if you are convicted or admit the commission of certain crimes during the residency period, even if the conviction or admission comes after naturalization. If that occurs and it's the appropriate type of conviction, then you don't have good moral character. A crime involving moral turpitude is one of those crimes. So if an applicant lacks good moral character and is not eligible for naturalization if they commit a crime involving moral turpitude during the statutory period, and later you're convicted of the crime or admit the crime or the criminal acts. And sexual assault of the child, which is the offense at issue in this case, is indisputably a crime of moral turpitude. What Padilla says is that if the immigration consequences of the plea are clear, then the advice has to be equally clear, and you have an affirmative duty to give that advice.
In this case, your position is that Mr. Gonzalez had all of the information available to him, knowing when the offenses were committed, knowing when he had applied for naturalization. And so he should have known the consequences and properly advised him.
Correct. Correct. When they're clear, you have to advise of the specific consequences, and not just you may be subject to deportation. You have to advise of what the specific consequences are. And the evidence in this
case, it appears that when Gallegos did file his application, you know, in 2010, he lied on his application. And you know, that he committed, I mean, that, you know, he didn't reveal to immigration that he had, you know, possibly committed a crime in 2007. So, you know, so even though he'd not been charged with anything, you know, is that fact that he hadn't been charged with anything, is that relevant to our analysis?
No, Your Honor, it is not relevant. And so that really goes to the prejudice argument, and the state is arguing that Mr. Gallegos would have been deported anyway because he lied on his application. And so the consequences of the plea and the conviction don't matter because since he lied on his application, he would have been deported anyway. So, but that's not the standard. And in fact, I think the court in Lee expressly rejected those same types of arguments. In that case, the government argued, well, whether he had pleaded or whether Mr. Lee had gone to trial, because of the strength of the evidence of guilt, he would have gotten deported anyway. So what's he getting out of this plea? He's getting less time. If he went to trial, he'd get more time and he'd still get deported. That's effectively the same argument that the state is now making. And the Supreme Court said, no, there are circumstances where the defendant will take the chance of what they called a Hail Mary trial to have that small chance that they can remain in the United States, because that is the priority. And this kind of goes directly to the prejudice argument, which I'll move to. The standard for prejudice is whether there is a reasonable probability that the defendant would have rejected the plea and gone to trial had he been properly advised of the immigration consequences. And that's directly out of the Hill case and then reaffirmed in Lee versus United States. And what Lee says is, if the defendant testifies as much that he would have gone to trial had he known, then the court looks at contemporaneous evidence to substantiate the defendant's expressed preferences. And the court doesn't have to just accept the bare assertion by the defendant that they would not have pleaded guilty. Importantly, in Lee, the court held that the defendant is not required to show that he would have been better off going to trial. Just because the evidence of guilt is strong and a conviction is likely doesn't mean that a defendant is irrational in claiming that he would have gone for the Hail Mary and gone to trial. And for that reason, it likewise doesn't matter that in the event of a conviction, the defendant would have been deported anyway and is risking a longer sentence to end up the same place.
The state has argued that the trial court was still in the position to not believe what Mr. Gallegos testified to. Are you saying that is not correct?
Well, the problem is that Mr. Gonzalez, the trial attorney, he never disputed that he didn't tell Mr. Gallegos the consequences. The only evidence in the record is that there was misadvice and a lack of advice. The distinction that the state tries to make between those two was rejected in Padilla. It's not about error of commission or omission here. It's, was the defendant advised of the consequences of the plea? And the only evidence in the record, the only evidence, just like in Lee, it is that he would not have taken that plea deal had he known. Now, in Lee, there's a distinction because Lee repeatedly asked his trial lawyer, is there going to be a deportation consequence? Is there going to be a deportation consequence? But in the Second Circuit case that we've cited, Rodriguez, the court said, well, you can't really fault a defendant who doesn't keep asking the same questions over and over again when the the advice that was given at the very outset of the representation was there will be no consequences here. And so Mr. Gonzalez's testimony that Mr. Gallegos was trying to avoid jail time, that doesn't really do anything to support the denial of habeas relief. It's actually, I think, completely irrelevant, given the fact that the only testimony really is that had I known, I would not have gone and pleaded guilty. Because effectively, the plea colloquy and the guilty plea and the judgment handed the government denaturalization on a silver platter.
Does the evidence in the record that reflects that Gallegos wanted to avoid trial at all costs, is that relevant, you know, to our...
I think it's not when you view it in the context of Mr. Gonzalez's testimony was, I went over the plea paperwork with him. That's the only place in his affidavit where Mr. Gonzalez says, I discussed any immigration consequences with him. And we know from the plea paperwork, it only applied to non-citizens. It didn't talk about denaturalization consequences. So when he says that Gallegos was focused on avoiding jail time, well, of course he was, because he had been told from the outset that there would be no deportation consequences. We shouldn't fault a defendant for trusting the advice of his counsel, even when that counsel is wrong, because otherwise you put the defendants in a situation where only a distrustful defendant who's repeatedly questioning about immigration consequences can get relief, whereas a defendant who has a right to rely on his attorney's advice, who gets bad advice, relies on it, and doesn't keep asking the same question over and over again, and instead focuses on avoiding jail time, can't get relief. I think that the answer to your question is that it doesn't change and it doesn't affect the analysis here, because the only evidence is, had I known, I wouldn't have gone to trial. And so
I have to circle back to my question that I just asked on that, because you seem to be arguing that that was the only evidence, so the trial court was bound to accept it. But don't we have to give deference to her on the credibility? She was still in a position to choose to believe or disbelieve that one statement, correct?
Well, no, I don't think that she should be able to disregard uncontradicted evidence in the record when, and what Lee says is, you know, there really can't be any dispute that he wouldn't have gone to trial because that was the only evidence. And I think that if you adopt a different standard, then you're undermining the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. I see my time is out. If the court doesn't have any questions, I'll wait for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mrs. Voss.
Thank you.
Mr. Gonzalez.
Good morning, Your Honors. First, I want to talk about whether Padilla is extended to this situation. Padilla, by its very terms, involves non-citizens. Criminal defense attorneys have to provide non-citizens with advice regarding immigration consequences as if they plead. There is no, as pointed out by the state and the defendant's brief here, or appellant's brief, there is no case from the Supreme Court or from the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals or any of the lower Texas courts that extend Padilla in this way. There are some cases that are cited by both the state and appellant. I believe appellant mentioned both cases. One was Caode and the other was Rodriguez. The state cautions the court in the persuasiveness that this court should give to those cases. See, he has KO'd, the defendant in KO'd pled guilty to federal charges. And one of the federal charges that KO'd pled guilty to was illegal procurement of naturalization. And it just so happens there's a statute that's related to that specific offense. And it requires the district court to revoke naturalization when a defendant is convicted of that particular offense. So that's a little bit different here because in our case, we're dealing with a state crime. So it's a little bit different. I'm not saying it's not persuasive or the court shouldn't look at it completely, but there are a lot of nuances in relation to that. Rodriguez is another case which a defendant had pled guilty to federal fraud charges. Rodriguez kind of also assumes that Padilla is extended to denaturalization. Doesn't really make any analysis. It just kind of assumes that it does. And it actually cites back to Padilla as support for that proposition. So that isn't really helpful for the court in determining whether there's a legal authority on this issue. The state is not really sure whether or not that this issue is determinative, because even if it was, this court still has to review the trial court's findings of facts and conclusions of law. In this case, there was no findings regarding ineffectiveness. First of all, the law requires that appellant prove the two-prong test in Strickland. That test requires that the appellant proves his attorney was ineffective, and that the second prong is that the appellant was prejudiced by that ineffectiveness.
And counsel, let me stop you there. So do you agree that Gonzalez's representation was deficient, and are you mainly relying on this, the last prong, which is the prejudice argument?
Well, this is a review of the trial court's findings, and it didn't touch on ineffectiveness. But in any case, regardless of whether the first prong is met, the state's primary argument is about prejudice, because the findings touch a bit on prejudice. For example, Your Honor, it's a two-prong test. An appellant has to meet both prongs, not one or the other, but both. So the fact that the trial court decided against the finding of prejudice is basically indicates that that appellant didn't meet his burden of proof in order to prove both. But yes, essentially most of the state's argument relates to prejudice. Now, prejudice, there's a lot of factors that a court can consider that's relevant to prejudice. The state or the appellant didn't really cite any cases related to it, at least not directly. But some of the cases that both the state and appellant have cited in its brief talk about prejudice. For instance, Padilla itself talks about how the defendant has to prove that his decision to reject a plea would be rational or not. Cahill talks about several factors for assessing prejudice. For instance, there's a quote from Cahill in the case. And the quote is, in assessing prejudice, we consider the totality of the circumstances, including Cahill's evidence to support his assertion, his likelihood of success at trial, the risk Cahill would have faced at trial, Cahill's representation about his desire to retract his plea, his connections to the United States and the district court's admonishments. So, and there's a footnote in Cahill in which right after that statement, the court in Cahill says, this is not an exhaustive list of factors. So there's a ton of things that the court can consider when assessing prejudice.
How do you respond to Mrs. Voss's argument regarding the uncontroverted nature of Mr. Gallegos' testimony, saying that he definitely would not have pled had he been properly advised by Mr. Gonzalez?
In a Article 11072 writ, the trial court is a finder of fact, and it gets to make its determinations of the historical facts, which this court has to give deference to. When the trial court's a fact finder, it gets to accept or reject all, some, or none of the evidence, even those that are quote unquote uncontradicted. This is not different in any other scenario. A good example, just a quick one off the top of my head. The trial court is the fact finder in a motion to suppress. Often in a motion to suppress, the state only presents an officer, and the trial court gets to decide whether it believes that officer or not. And when the state appeals a decision, the court is stuck with those fact findings based on credibility and demeanor. So even in scenarios where evidence is, I guess, quote unquote, uncontradicted, there's nothing in the law that says a trial court has to credit that testimony. It does not have to. There are a lot of reasons here why the trial court could have not credited appellant's testimony. And this court is essentially kind of stuck with those factual findings. What can be reviewed is the legal conclusions. I believe the court can review the legal conclusions de novo, but otherwise this court's kind of stuck with those fact findings. And the state's mentioning this, emphasizing this, because appellant has asked this court to reverse and render, not reverse and remand, reverse and render. Reverse and render would essentially require this court to substitute its own factual findings with that of the trial courts. And that would be not giving the trial court the proper deference it deserves on appeal. For that reason, the state would ask that would be, or would point out that it would be an improper action by this court. Now I want to touch on the ways in which appellant is can be revoked from his naturalization. The statute actually doesn't require conviction. The statute merely says that the federal government has to show that the appellant committed or admitted to committing an offense constituting a crime of moral turpitude. In this case, there was a voluntary statement of accused. That voluntary statement of accused basically came into existence prior to the indictment, prior to the plea. In this case, essentially here, because that voluntary statement of accused exists, and in that voluntary statement of accused is an admission of the offense committed, the federal government could use
Let me ask you that. Are you talking about he signed a confession before he had counsel?
Correct. During the investigation of this case, prior to an indictment, yes, that's what the state's referring to, not the judicial stipulation of evidence.
Okay. Sorry.
No problem, Your Honor. That means that even if appellant rejected the plea and went to trial and was even acquitted in this case, he would still be at risk for denaturalization because there's evidence that existed prior to this plea proceeding that would establish that he committed an offense. So that goes towards.
Is it proper for us to take that into consideration in our determination of prejudice?
Well, as stated before, Your Honor, the court gets to look at totality of circumstances and gets to assess whether it would have been rational for appellant to reject the plea deal here. And the state posits.
And was that statement introduced into evidence as part of the plea package?
I believe at the yes, it was, and it's part of the plea package, and the habeas court took judicial notice of all the contents of the court's file, so it's in the record before the court for assessment. Essentially, because prejudice is a totality of the circumstances case, virtually everything is relevant, including this including how the denaturalization statute applies to this particular defendant. And I think it's relevant that the trial court could have found that it wouldn't have been rational for appellant to reject the plea deal in this case because of the effect it would have. Essentially, it doesn't matter whether or not appellant would have been acquitted or not either in this case. And that's kind of the difference between this case and Lee. See, Lee involved a defendant who faced deportation consequences. It's different from denaturalization, but the thing is that deportation consequence was dependent on Lee's conviction. Here, a conviction is not needed for denaturalization. All it requires is an admission, and that's straight in the statute, which exists. So that makes this case significantly different than Lee. So the state believes that the trial court could have considered this and used that as a way to conclude that appellant had met its burden, at least specifically as to prejudice. There was other statements, I believe, in the reply brief. Appellant kind of mentioned how trial counsel could have filed a motion to suppress the statement. The problem with that argument is at the habeas hearing, the appellant didn't enter any evidence that would suggest that that statement was involuntary. So essentially that argument is waived. Another thing that appellant complains about is testimony that the state elicited from the defendant at the habeas hearing. Essentially, the state elicited testimony about whether the appellant admitted to committing the offense or not. And he did at the habeas hearing. Appellant makes arguments that that is not relevant, that should have been not let in. However, as talked about just a few minutes ago, his admission of the crime is completely relevant to the application of the revocation statute. And not just that, appellant himself opened the door to that situation because appellants had argued that the state perhaps could have offered another plea deal that would have resolved this issue. However, there was no evidence put before the habeas court that the state was amenable to even offering a lower charge. That was just kind of thrown out there. There was no evidence about that. And a principle of a basic criminal law is what the lawyers say is an evidence. So unless this court has any other questions, Your Honor, the state requests this court to affirm the trial court's ruling.
Just ask you this one question on that last point you made about a different charge. I mean, I'm trying to think of any charge that would not involve moral turpitude surround that could have come out of the circumstances, you know, the allegations in this case. I mean, even if it would be dropped to a misdemeanor, wouldn't that be sufficient for it to trigger the denaturalization?
The state has thought about this and we have not come up with a lower charge that would, I guess, save the appellant from denaturalization. Mm-hmm. I mean, often here, when the state makes a plea offer, it considers the evidence that it has against the defendant, sure. Mm-hmm. Right? And so in this case, there was an admission. Mm-hmm. And so there's no evidence that the state would have even offered a lower charge or what that lower charge would be, or a lower charge that would save this appellant from denaturalization. Mm-hmm. So if there's any other questions, the state asks this court to affirm the trial court's order.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gonzalez. Mrs. Voss, you have your 7 minutes remaining. You need to unmute.
Thank you. I was trying to keep the coughing quiet. So the first argument I want to address is the argument that Padilla shouldn't apply. In the Coyote case, the state has argued that that case involved a charge of basically fraudulently obtaining naturalization, but that wasn't the only charge in that case. And the court nevertheless applied Padilla. Rodriguez applied Padilla. It didn't just assume that Padilla applied, it actually applied it. And really the state has not given any good reason not to apply Padilla, except for that just Padilla arose in the specific circumstances of a non-citizen. But the reasoning of Padilla is that the immigration consequences from a guilty plea are, while they are civil, they are so intertwined with the punishment that a defense counsel has a duty, when those immigration consequences are clear, to provide clear advice, warning of those consequences. And the court was not willing to say that those are collateral consequences that shouldn't be advised. And I don't think you could get any worse of a immigration consequence than getting your citizenship completely revoked and then deported. So there's really no good reason why this court should not apply Padilla. Second, the state argued that that some of the cases that have been cited involve numerous factors that the courts consider when looking at prejudice. And one of the ones that the state mentioned was the Coyote case from the Fifth Circuit, where they looked at the risk faced at trial, the likelihood of success at trial. That was before the Lee decision came out in 2017. And the Lee decision made it clear that just because the defendant faces a great risk at trial and the outcome may be the same regarding deportation, that's not really a relevant factor. What they're looking at is the overarching inquiry is there a reasonable probability, not a certainty, but a reasonable probability that the defendant would have refused the plea deal and gone to trial. And so you have to look at a statement from the defendant that that's the case. And then you need to have some basically corroboration based on the circumstances of that person. And in the Lee case, it was that he had been in the United States for 35 years. He had businesses here. He had family here. He had no ties to South Korea. Here, we have Mr. Gallegos being here since 2003, had become a naturalized citizen, had all of his family here. And then the additional statement that he was afraid to go back to Mexico, would have never agreed to that because of all of the cartel violence and the risks associated with that. That's the only evidence in the record on what would have happened had he been properly advised. Now, the state says, well, you can reject that uncontradicted testimony and adopt the trial court's findings. Where is the fact finding that says that Gallegos would have gone to trial had he known the consequences? There is no fact finding that says that. So the only evidence in the record that can't really be disputed, just like in Lee, is that he would not have gone to trial had he known of the immigration consequences. And I'll point out that in Lee, while the magistrate's findings, adopted that as a fact finding, the trial court still went on and said, well, he was facing such a great risk at trial that this was just not even a rational decision that anybody could make. And the Sixth Circuit adopted that. And the Supreme Court reversed that. So in this case, there is no specific fact finding that Mr. Gallegos would not have accepted the plea had he known the consequences. There is no finding that Mr. Gallegos' testimony was not credible in that regard. The only evidence is the record that is in the record is that he wouldn't have accepted. And then there is a fact finding that he was concerned about not having jail time. But you have to take that in context of the evidence. The only evidence is that he never got any kind of warnings. And the Rodriguez case says that you can't fault the defendant for not continuing to ask and counsel, those questions.
How about the state's argument that I guess you could say no harm, no foul, because whether he was admonished by the lawyer or by the court, there was already a written statement where he had accepted or he had agreed or admitted to having committed a crime of moral turpitude, and that the statute does not require conviction for deportation or denaturalization in this case, because, that one statement that he gave prior to he even appearing in court or having anything to do with this attorney in particular.
Your Honor, I think that the court has rejected that argument in Lee because, I mean, the same would be true of the risk of deportation at the end of a criminal trial, because if you go to trial and you lose and you have all the evidence stacked against you and it's likely that you're going to lose, especially since based on the state's argument, well, we had this conviction or this confession, the Supreme Court said no, the consequences of losing your status, your immigration status, can be so harsh that a defendant will take that risk. I mean, the government would still have to plead for that and would still have to prove up the conviction. And if the defendant was able to convince the immigration court that that statement was involuntary, then he's got an argument. With a conviction, all the state has to do is put in the conviction. So there is substantial harm. And that's what we allege. The state is the one that has raised all these other arguments about possible other ways to deport him. But when you look at it, he should have been advised that giving this plea and getting this judgment handed it to the state or the government on a silver platter. I see my time's up. So if the court doesn't have any further questions, I'll just ask that that the court reverse the judgment.
Any further questions, justices? Okay, very interesting case. Thank you. Good job by both of you. We appreciate it. So the case will be under submission as of today.
Thank you.
Y'all have a good day. Thank you.